Well, hello there. You're still here. Glad to hear it. This is Aaron with the Cloud Radio Show, and we greatly appreciate your listenership. Thank you for being along for the cloud journey. We created the show to increase your understanding of IT services and the cloud, in partnership with Paul Roberts from OC Talk Radio, where we record live in studio. Network Remedy is the sponsor of the show and is an IT consulting firm, managed services provider, and cloud hosting solution based out of San Jose, California in Silicon Valley. In this episode, we had a chat with Michael Jenkins, Linux engineer, host of South Bay Foodies podcast, and implementer of the cloud as a career. We discussed various cloud definitions, service offerings such as Azure and AWS, as well as what the future holds for the cloud. As always, we will have detailed show notes, which can be found at networkremedy.com/blog. Let's get this show started. See you in the cloud.
Thank you for listening to The Cloud on Network Remedy Radio.
Where is Aaron right now?
Welcome to The Cloud, a weekly show discussing all aspects of the cloud and how it relates to people, enterprises, and society. Our goal is to make traditionally complex concepts of the cloud accessible to the general public for personal and professional use. Here's your host, Aaron Mungall.
Hello there, friends of the cloud. Thank you for joining us on another episode of The Cloud. I'm here with Paul Roberts, our talking head and engineer, the curious common man.
Yes, sir. Are there really friends of the cloud? Is it like a society?
It's a society, I'm thinking. It's like it could even potentially be a secret society, you know?
In fact, I was at the airport and they were collecting for the friends of the cloud here.
Ah, yes. We have a secret handshake. We have secret code words that we...
Do you shave your head like Krishna's? Do they proselytize and go out and convert?
You either shave your head or grow it really long. So I think I'm on the growing hair long part.
Okay.
Our guest this week is Michael Jenkins. He's a Linux engineer and implementer of cloud services. He really is in the trenches with day-to-day. He works with the cloud. He has a BS and MS in computer engineering from Iowa State University. He worked for Toyota, where he managed the whole shebang, building their cloud environment from scratch, including Amazon Web Services and their EC2 and S3 offerings. In addition, Michael has utilized Microsoft Azure and Rackspace, among other cloud vendors, depending on the needs of the organizations he works with. Today, Michael works as a Linux engineer for AdventStar and also hosts his own podcast called South Bay Foodies, based out of Manhattan Beach, California.
South Bay Foodies, of course.
Exactly. Right. So got to give some love to the fellow podcasters and radio people. And yeah, so we're going to talk about the cloud offerings out there, some advantages and disadvantages, as well as how he keeps up with this very fast-moving industry and
I can't keep
market
up with it.
Exactly. So, you know, he's Michael. First of all, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Aaron. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Absolutely. And just tell us a little bit about, you know, who you are, what you do, and how you do it.
Yeah, sure. So, I know you said I'm a Linux engineer. That's kind of by title, but
sure.
To add a little bit of background to that. By education, I'm a computer engineer. I was trained in circuit design. So I learned in school all about VLSI production, making microprocessors and circuits and that type of thing. And my goal there was to be a circuit designer to make chips for Intel or whoever. But I ended up being an application engineer, and that is supporting other engineers who were designing circuits. So in that environment, I really picked up Linux and Unix as an aside of supporting the tools, the circuit design tools that ran on HP UX or AIX or whatever the operating system we were using at the time. So that kind of built up my command line skills, my scripting skills and programming skills and that type of thing. And I was an application engineer, support engineer for the better part of my career. Most recently, say the past 4 years or so, I've been almost completely focused on supporting web services that run on cloud, cloud-based infrastructures or internally hosted infrastructure.
How did you make that transition? I actually was reading your LinkedIn profile a little bit, and I saw the thing about where you worked on like ASICs and FPGAs. So I'm curious how you went from sort of a hardware function to, you know, the more of the web and software side of things. It seems like you were able to transition pretty naturally, and I'm curious how that took place.
Yeah, sure. So I really enjoyed designing circuit, because at the time that I was doing circuit design, we were really getting into doing FPGAs, which are field programmable gate arrays. And essentially, you're programming the logic into the chip as opposed to laying out transistors and, you know, layers and that type of thing. So as a part of that process, there's a lot of software that's involved with compiling the code and then synthesizing the code down to transistors and then laying out those transistors into the circuit. And having all that software running on a Unix or Linux system kind of lends itself to automation. So I got really good at learning the tools and learning how to automate the processes with Perl scripts, with Bash scripts. And basically, I got to the point where I was doing my job as a circuit designer so well and so efficiently that my manager wanted me to train the other engineers on how to, you know, I would basically show them how I was automating everything. So I got into a role where I was doing more support work, you know, helping people do their jobs faster than doing the actual job itself. So, I mean, that was my first job right out of school at Rockwell Collins, and I was there for a couple of years and went to IBM and was supporting a network team, I should say a network processor team, doing pretty much the same thing. So, you know, really using Linux a lot, but the goal being to automate the design process as efficiently as possible. So, I mean, kind of walking down that route, you know, I learned a lot of good scripting skills, a lot of good programming skills, and also learning how to use the Linux operating system, you know, to kind of host all of that.
Did you take any formal training on this, or was this more of a sort of on-the-job learning, you know, experience?
Most of it was just on-the-job trial by fire. And I tell you what, one of the best books that I ever read was Unix in a Nutshell. It's one of the O'Reilly books. I can't remember what the wood carving, you know, animal on the cover of it is. But I do remember the title, Unix in a Nutshell. And reading that book, I learned VI. I learned how to use Make. I read the Perl books by Larry Wall. So I got, you know, Perl was, I call Perl my native language.
Nice.
Because almost any scripting task I did, I you know, I would reach for Perl first. So a lot of it was just on the job, like, hey, this is what we need to do. How are we going to do it? Figured it out and, you know, then just kind of made it happen from there. Any more formal training that I've gotten has been for applications themselves. Like, for instance, one of the applications that I support now is Alfresco, which is an open source content management system. And I have gone to formal training for that. So, not so much the underlying skill as far as like, you know, learning how to script and learning how to use Linux. Have I gotten formal training like, you know, on that? Like say, for instance, I don't have any Linux certification. Most of that experience I've gotten just kind of on the job or reading books or, you know, getting some training or I should say mentoring, from other folks that know how to do the task.
This is Paul Roberts, the common everyman here.
Curious common man.
Always trying to sift through all these certifications and programs and platforms and all this kind of stuff. And I'm just wondering, what is the state of Linux today? You know, I remember when Linux came out, this open source competitor to Microsoft, and people thought, well, it'll never take off. And it sort of flopped around for a while, and now it seems to be the opposite. It seems almost, my perception is Microsoft is trying to chase them through things like Azure and stuff, that they're trying to do more to gain back, because everybody seems to be writing stuff in Linux. Is that true? Or using Linux?
That is true. And I think really where the turn came, because like right out of school, and just to kind of, I guess, put that into a timeline, perspective for me, that was about 1996-97.
Right.
And we were using HP UX and Solaris as our primary operating system. And that's when Linux kind of, really come into bear, and people were talking about it, say, hey, what's this thing, Linux? And we weren't using it as much. And so, you know, people kind of started to dabble and use it some more. And, Red Hat, you know, came about, and they were actually providing support. So, you know, businesses say, well, hey, if I use this Linux operating system, I can get support for it just like I can from, you know, Microsoft or HP UX.
Right.
And so on. And I think that kind of gave it some traction. And then ultimately the cost became the biggest factor, in my opinion, because what businesses could do was get off the shelf or, you know, very cheap hardware, almost disposable compute power, and then they could get a free operating system to run on. Particularly, I mean, the one that I use daily, we use here at AdvancedStar, is SynthOS, and it's, you know, binary equivalent to Red Hat Enterprise Linux. So if you're using, you know, the same Linux that's supported by Red Hat and you can get it for free, you know, you can't, it's hard for, you know, businesses to say, well, you know, we're not even going to consider that. They have to take a look at it and say, well, hey, let's at least see, you know, where we can go with this if we're going to be able to reduce our costs and, you know, kind of save our bottom line.
So how do people like Microsoft and others get back in the game if somebody can do more with a free underlying operating system? Is it through the add-ons? I'm looking at the website for Microsoft Azure, or however they say it, and it says Azure.
Yeah, Azure, I'm not sure.
Azure. I'll make a little French sound to it. Azure. Is Microsoft, this is what their explanation of it. It's Microsoft's cloud computing platform, a growing collection of integrated services, including analytics, computing, database, mobile, networking, storage, and web for moving faster, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is that so? Would that then run on an underlying Windows operating system? Is that how they trick you back to Windows and pay for their operating system? Or does this stuff operate, these add-ons, this analytics and database and stuff, will that work, integrate into a Linux platform as well?
Well, the underlying technology, I will say I'm not really sure. But as far as Azure goes, the services that you can consume, like say if you want to spin up a VM in Azure,
right,
then you're going to be able to use whatever operating system you want to. But they have offerings where you can use Windows 2012, 2008, or you can spin up a Linux VM as well. I think Ubuntu is the main one that they offer, but you might be able to use Red Hat as well. I'd have to double check that one. But,
so how did...
So for all this...
Go ahead, sorry.
Go ahead.
No, finish your
No,
comment.
I was just going to say, so as far as the underlying, like, analytics and, you know, whatever data that they pull out, yeah, they might be running it on their own services that run Windows Server. But as far as the services that you want to use on Azure, you can use whatever you want to. They let you run Linux there as well.
So I guess I'm just wondering, you know, what's the state of Microsoft these days? At one time, they were talking about breaking them up because they were seen as a monopoly. And then along comes Linux and others, and in many ways bypasses them or replaces them. And if Linux is now the platform of choice because it's open source and it's free, how does Microsoft get back in the game? Is it just at the consumer level still with consumer laptops and everything, or are they going to be an enterprise player that specializes in just things like analytics and whatever else is in the Azure platform here?
Sure. So, I mean, I will have to say that I'm not a Microsoft expert by any means.
Yeah, I'm just
a Microsoft.
Yeah, I'm not looking to somebody to tout Microsoft or tear them down at the other hand, but I'm just curious. You're in the world there, and you're focusing on a Linux platform here, and yet you mention in your certifications and things you do is Azure is one of them. I'm wondering if that's in addition, if these two play well together, and if that's the future of Microsoft is finding specialized niches, or are they going to still try and compete, and you know, you mentioned some other platforms and stuff too. Are we going to end up with one Linux world and all these other people are going to add services to it, or are they going to still try and convince you to come back to their underlying platform here?
Sure. So, yeah, if I had a crystal ball and were to look into it, you know, say 5 years out.
I thought you did. That's what Aaron assured me, that you had the crystal ball here today and thought we had you on.
Let me polish it up here a little bit.
All right.
So I can see. So I think what Microsoft would probably need to do from a, the consumer level perspective,
yeah,
start giving away their operating system for free.
Wow.
The hardware itself is getting cheaper and cheaper, where you can get a tablet or, you know, one of these, what do they call it, like yoga tablets, where it turns into a laptop or a tablet.
Yeah.
That
right.
type of thing. You can get those for $500 for a pretty decent one. And if the manufacturer is going to have to charge you more because they have to pay these OEM costs to Microsoft for the operating system, then that's going to become kind of a hurdle, especially if you can get, say, for instance, an Android tablet where the operating system is essentially free. Mm-hmm. You have the same capabilities then, you know, say you get that one for $100, $200, and you have this Windows-based laptop or tablet that's, you know, $500, $1,000, or whatever the case is. Of course, the hardware may be different.
Is Android an underlying Linux system, or is it a separate?
It is.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
It is. It's a Linux variant. So.
Right.
But yeah, all that is to say is I think at the consumer level, Microsoft is going to have to get to the point where they're giving away, you know, the Windows desktop operating system for free. As far as the enterprise, I think they'll be able to get away with selling Windows Server 2012 or, you know, say 2017 at that point.
Right.
And providing the services to support it. I think enterprise will still be interested in having, you know, people that are certified to administer those operating systems. And also a company that's going to back the support and the update and maintenance.
I got you. So it's the back end support that makes people feel comfortable, not the underlying system itself, which doesn't seem to have any. I don't know. Is there any benefit to using Microsoft versus Linux? Is there something you can do in Microsoft or vice versa? Is there, or are they both kind of end up with the same capabilities?
I think that they're both going to be at the same capabilities. The software might be different. But I think if you say, hey, I need to sit down at this computer, and if it's Linux or Windows, it's not going to matter. And say, if you need to say, hey, I need to sit down at this computer and surf the web, you're going to be able to do that. You say, I need to do this presentation. You can do that. You know, I need to even edit this video or this audio. I think you're going to be able to do that regardless if you're sitting down at, hey, we haven't even talked about Mac. If you're sitting down at a Mac or a Windows system, or a Linux system, I think that you're going to be able to do that regardless of the operating system.
So, Michael,
I just
to step back a little bit, how did you first encounter the cloud? I know we're talking about operating systems and sort of this is a nice natural progression. You know, you had your background in computer science and the circuits and then software. And then how did the cloud come into your world? Or you come into the cloud's world, depending on how you look at it.
Was it just a rainy day and the cloud came over and sucked you up and what?
Yeah, sure. Well, my first exposure with the cloud was with Amazon Web Services and kind of their offering into cloud computing. That's what really kind of piqued my interest when they were saying, you know, you don't need to maintain your data center in-house. If you need a VM or if you need a system to connect to, just, you know, log into this web page and spin up a VM. We'll give you credentials.
And remind everybody what a VM is for those less technically oriented.
Yeah, sure. Sure. When I say VM, I mean virtual machine.
Right.
Yeah. So that's essentially a guest computer that's running on top of the services provided by another computer.
And the thing that's interesting about virtual machines is technically it's not the cloud per se, right? It's like our CEO calls it cloud-like in functionality, but officially, am I correct on that? Or it functions like the cloud, but it's not necessarily officially the cloud per se, or is it actually the cloud, the virtual machine?
Are we splitting hairs? Because it's not sitting in your office there, so it's a virtual machine somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, virtual machine, that concept can be applied to a desktop computer. Say, for instance, I could be running VirtualBox or VMware Player on my laptop, and I could be running another, I could be running a VM using that software and accessing another computer even locally at my desktop. So yeah, that's not cloud per se. So VM isn't exclusive to the cloud.
So you can be remotely accessing a computer within your organization as well as out there in the cloud somewhere parked in Pakistan or whatever.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and Amazon Web Service and all the other cloud providers, they have data centers all over the world. So I mean, once you spin up your VM, you're probably going to know the region that VM is located in. So you'll have an idea whether it's in Virginia or if it's in Ireland or something like that. But it could be anywhere in the world. Or, like I said, if you have the software running on your laptop, you could be running that same or similar VM right there, you know, locally.
And if it's running in Ireland, does it have an accent? No, probably not.
It's just my Aaron O'Brien.
That's right.
What would you say are the main benefits of Amazon Web Services, both from, you know, functions and, like, just, you know, how it's useful or valuable for what you were trying to accomplish?
Yeah, sure. So the first thing that I really liked was, like I said, being able to spin up a computer with pretty much any operating system that I needed at, kind of at a moment's notice. So to kind of give that a little clarity, so I'm a computer guy, right? I've got, you know, a ton of old computers at home that are, you know, clogging up my office. I've got more in the garage. And whenever I wanted to have a network of computers, I had to pull out all these computers. I had to plug them in, configure them, build the operating system, and get them, you know, all talking to each other and that type of thing. And it's kind of a hassle to do all that. But if just because you're dealing with the hardware, it, with when I first looked at Amazon Web Services, I was like, oh man, I can, you know, spin up 3 VMs with a couple clicks and have them all talking together in maybe 15 or 20 minutes, as opposed to the couple hours that's going to take just to get all the hardware together that I would need to build a simple or similar kind of configuration.
In the old days, you had to run the wires from one to the next, and you hang them out the window, and you brought them in here, and
right,
you did
exactly
all this stuff. Yeah, right.
And that would be if you were doing it yourself, right? Like in your own setup, it would take a lot more time to accomplish that.
And that used to be what companies like a Network Remedy, I assume, used to do, is that they'd come in and I want to have 30 computers or 300 computers and I want them all linked together and I want them connected to a server that backs up all this stuff here. And they would run the little wires from floor to floor and they would set them all up and they'd write some custom programs and we'd have all this stuff layered in and it would all be my network. Now my network has been replaced by this virtual, this network, and we can't even picture where it is, so we just say it's in the cloud. It's out there somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
So before, like, each implementation you would have to do from scratch, and it would be very time, it would take a lot of time. If you were on payroll, it would probably be costly. But now you're saying you can do it in a moment's notice, as you put it, 15 to 20 minutes versus hours or maybe even days if the people were lacking expertise or longer.
That's correct. I mean, and the benefit of using, you know, a service like AWS or Amazon Web Services, I mean, they have different, what I want to call different sizes of servers, from like a small server, they might call it a T2 micro, to something that's, you know, much larger, has more CPU, more RAM, more memory. So again, going back to this hardware on site type configuration, if I need to get a faster computer than what I have, I'm going to have to put it in order and I'm going to have to sit there and wait for that computer to arrive. But with a cloud-based service, if I need a new, more powerful computer or different configuration, or RAM or CPU or whatever the case is, you know, a couple clicks and I've got it. It just kind of changes the whole game that way.
So here's the question I keep struggling with, and you guys are the right ones to ask here. So as we move from hardware on-site to hardware off-site, up in the cloud in some mysterious other place, and all this stuff is there, and I can instantly upgrade, and the machines are upgraded, and I can get whatever I want whenever I want. I don't have to physically order the hardware, ship it to my offices, plug it in, connect it together, get it all to work together. In that world where the hardware is off-site more and more, does that mean that the IT people go away as well? Do they go off-site as well? Do I need an IT department that's running from floor to floor or building to building or campus to campus if, in fact, there's nothing on my campus?
Well, the short answer to that, I would say, is yes and no.
Okay.
So here's the long answer. So the yes part of it is, I think with the minimization of on-site compute needs, or, you know, the reduction of on-site compute needs,
right,
is that, yeah, you're gonna need fewer people to support that, that kind of footprint. So, and also, yeah, that person, whoever's doing the support, they could be anywhere. For instance, for me, I just need an internet connection and my VPN client to be able to connect to our network, and I can pretty much do my job anywhere.
Exactly.
To kind of give you the perspective, say, you know, I'm on a team of two people, two Linux engineers, and we have one network engineer, and we have three or four Windows engineers that help us maintain the infrastructure for our company, which is just a division of a larger company.
Okay.
And we manage, upwards of a few hundred servers.
Wow.
So just with that small team, we're able to support that infrastructure. A lot of it's virtual, some of it's physical, but just that small of a team, you know, we could manage that. The no part is, you're still going to need people that need desk side support or office support. So if you're, you know, your password needs to be changed or you can't connect to a printer, you're still going to need somebody that, you know, at your desktop is going to be able to provide that support for you.
But eventually we may end up with just dumb machines, dumb terminals, and we're printing in the cloud, we're storing in the cloud, we're doing everything in the cloud here, and this is just our terminal to get into the cloud, our passport to get into the cloud.
Nexus.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is true. So, and I think a Chromebook is a good example of that.
Right.
Because with a Chromebook, you can log in with your Google account or whatever, and all your settings are saved in the cloud. Once you log into this, you know, bare-bones Chromebook, all of your settings are pulled down. That Chromebook is configured to operate the way that you have it set up. Yeah, so you're good to go at that point.
So,
if, say, for instance, you're connected to the network, the printer that you want to print to is connected to the network, and they're joined together in the cloud, then, yeah, you don't even need to plug in. You just click print.
Yeah, for example, I've been playing with a Google Chromebook, and so I have a home office where I have a printer set up there, and, of course, I have a printer here at our studio. And sometimes I want to print at my house and my other office here, and I'll just go to Google Print in the cloud, and those are all hooked up now because they communicate. All these new printers communicate with the cloud and have an internet address, and I can just say print here and print that out over here and print it out over here, and it gets printed at three different physical locations here. And I start to wonder if that isn't the future here, and the on-site IT department is going to shrink because they got nothing to do. They still have stuff to do to maintain the servers and all this stuff, but that can be done from anywhere.
Sure, yeah, indeed. And I mean, when you look at cases like that, I think what you know, small to mid-sized companies will do is outsource that support. So, you know, you would have a company that, you know, you would call, you put in a ticket, and they have a service guy that shows up,
right,
takes care of your needs. You know, he's got, you know, say, you know, 10 or 15 other customers that he takes care of.
Right.
But what that does, I think, is that helps companies get back to their core business. So if say if you have a staff of 20 today and two or three of those people are IT, and I mean, it would be unfortunate to have to let them go, but if you prioritize and say, you know what, we can outsource our IT needs and really, you know, focus on what we do as a business, I think that just kind of helps the business streamline in the long term.
And I'll tell you, the other thing I think it helps, we're calling these, you know, I think they're all called, like, the company Aaron's with managed service providers here, where they're now providing this service. They're managing your IT services from remote locations here, from offsite.
Sure.
I see there's another advantage here, and I think this is what we're going to get into after the commercial here in a moment, which is how do you keep up to date with all this stuff? I've hired Joe. Joe was great at XYZ platform or XYZ systems or setting up the old network, but it's been replaced. It's been updated. It's been changed. It's gone to this. It's gone to the cloud. It's gone somewhere else here. This stuff is changing at lightning speeds, new ideas, new technologies, new ways to connect and do things and stuff. I don't know that old Joe, unless I pay for him to go get the certifications, he's my employee. I don't know that old Joe's up to snuff. I don't know that old Joe on his own is going to go out and go to these seminars and go to these, get these certifications and stay up to date on the latest technology. Whereas if I use, on a macro level, if I use Amazon Web Services, I know that I'm getting the latest and greatest stuff. So it's not only ease of updating and adding stuff, as you said originally, and it's not just about reducing my cost. It's also about staying up to date with the latest and greatest stuff without having to pay my IT staff to teach them how to do it. Right?
Yeah, understood. Yeah, indeed.
All right. Should we go take a commercial?
Yeah, let's
here?
Take a break. We're going to get back into the cloud vendor solutions a little bit, and then we'll go into, like you said, the pace of how do you keep up.
All right. All that more right after as we continue to clarify the cloud.
Brought to you by Network Remedy.
Rick Franzi, host of Critical Mass Radio Show, recently asked Amon Prasad, CEO of Network Remedy, to tell us about Network Remedy. Here's what he said.
So Network Remedy is, it started off as a consulting firm back in 2001, and we have since expanded into a managed services, a managed IT services firm, as well as a private cloud hosting solution provider.
Okay.
So we host our own data centers around the country, and we also provide the consulting services to clients to, in fact, you know, guide them into cloud services as well as manage anything that they may have on site, you know, servers, workstations, mobile devices.
Those two complement each other, don't they?
Absolutely. And that's really been the differentiating factor with us, as opposed to other providers in the area. You know, there are numerous managed services providers, and there are numerous cloud hosting providers.
Right.
However, not very many people that I know of have actually combined or married the two into one cohesive solution so that the end user, the end customer, is comfortable understanding the benefits of the cloud,
right,
as well as, you know, having the flexibility of having an actual person on site they can work with, having a consultant on site that they can work with. So, you know, we feel like we've successfully kind of combined those two complementary business models into one umbrella.
All right, we're back with Aaron and his guest here. We're talking about the cloud, and we're talking to one of those workers. You said in the trenches. You can't be in the trenches anymore. You got to be up in the sky somewhere.
That's right, floating in the cloud, right, on your flying machine.
Yeah.
So, Michael, tell us, okay, we went into AWS, and just really quick, AWS is a very, correct me if I'm wrong, please, it's a self-serve model. You need some expertise to be able to provision resources, and there's not as much of that support angle that a lot of other companies are going for. So I'd like to contrast that with Microsoft Azure. What is their value?
When I look at Azure compared to AWS, they're very similar in terms of the services that they provide. It's still kind of a self-service interface where you're going to have to, you initiate your account, and if you want some services, some servers spun up or some databases created, you're still going to have to know how to get into their interface and make that happen. There may be, some folks on their side that can kind of walk you through it. But still, kind of at the end of the day, you're going to need to know or have somebody that knows how to work the interface to get the...
So Azure still requires some IT expertise. It's not just something anyone can just pick up and play with, right? It's like there needs to be a little bit of understanding of what you need, the computing resources, and how much, where.
Why are you looking at me, Aaron, when you say that? Like when you say anybody couldn't do this. So I'm going to go to Azure. I'm going to play with it today. I'm going to open up AWS here. I wouldn't even know where to start. I really wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's fairly, once you get to it, it really what it boils down to is they're both, what I like to think of it, it's a web page. So if you can go to a web page and kind of click around and figure things out, then you too can, create your own virtual machine in the cloud.
Wow.
It's not rocket science.
But it's computer science.
Sorry, it's cloud science, right?
Yeah, it is computer science, but
thankfully the computer science is a little more forgiving and easier to use.
So how does that compare with other things like we had Rackspace on?
There's yeah, a big good question.
How does this compare with them? Do they offer the same stuff but more hand-holding and setup? Is that what differentiates them?
Well, and my experience with Rackspace is limited. I'm just getting started to working with Rackspace, so I don't have a good, basis of comparison.
Okay, but you have a perception. What's your perception? Rackspace. Yeah, why would you go? Why would you use them? Why would you recommend them versus just Amazon Web Services or anybody like them? I'm not saying them in particular, but anybody like them. There are a variety of them.
Sure. Yeah. Another one, I'm just kind of name dropping here, is DigitalOcean. And I would kind of put them on par with a Rackspace.
Okay.
As well, where, spinning up services there might be a little bit easier. Yeah, you might get a little bit more hand-holding and support from Rackspace and DigitalOcean than you may get on Amazon kind of out of the box.
Right.
Of course, you can always, pay for more support or find somebody to give you more support. But just out of the box, I think DigitalOcean might be one of the easiest ones.
And that's what I'm trying to get at. So why I'm a businessman. I have small to mid-sized company. Let's say I have a mid-sized company. I've got a manufacturing. I got a couple hundred people. I got some plants and operations in different places around the country, around the world here. What would lead me to go to more of a managed service and less of a do-it-yourself service? What would make me call Network Remedy here or other companies, managed service providers or people like yourself, and you'd say, in this case, you should go pay a little more and get the extra services, or no, I can do it for you and I'll just set it up I'll set up a virtual machine or whatever else you need here using
sure
something else.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, a lot of it's going to rely on, well, number one, the budget, how much you're willing to spend to get the result of the end result of what you need. Mm-hmm. And then also the capacity that you're looking for. So if, say, for instance, if you just wanted to spin up a WordPress server that you're going to, you know, document your trip to Niagara Falls on,
right,
then, yeah, you don't need managed services for that. I would you know, say, hey, you could probably do this on your own, or maybe even another cloud-based service. Just go to WordPress,
right,
and, you know, use the free tier over there, and you can get that done. But say, for instance, you want to run a enterprise-level storefront that's going to, you know, get, say, 10 million hits on Black Friday.
Right.
Then, yeah, you're going to need some support with that. Even if, say, you're a small company, but you got a product that everybody wants, and you don't have the IT staff in-house that can set that up, then, yeah, you're going to definitely need somebody that can architect that for you and get it set up for you.
And would you, or Aaron's company, or anybody else out here, all these other MSPs out here, would you then send me the company to just, you would, I'd pick you to set it up, and then you turn around and pick Amazon Web Services, or what would make you then go to the higher level DigitalOceans and stuff here? Do they just deal directly with people like the business owner, or do they go through people like you and Aaron and others and stuff here? Do you guys use them as well?
Yeah, from my perspective, I guess it kind of depends. For my personal needs, you know, I would just kind of, you know, take care of it for myself.
Right.
For say again, going back to the small business example, then you might want to go with a third party. And have them be the front end between you and Amazon to say, you know, that way you kind of maybe more, a little bit closer one-on-one support to say, hey, this is my business need. And once you explain your business needs to the third party, you know, consultant or managed services provider, then what they could do is take that need and architect it into a solution.
Got it.
And, you know, if they either hand you that solution and you implement it, or, you know, they take that on the next step and they implement it.
So what did you do with Toyota when Toyota came? Explain to that project here. Did they come to you? Or is that through another? Did somebody recommend you? Were you working under somebody or directly for Toyota? And what type of thing did you set up for them?
Yeah, sure. So at Toyota, I was actually, I was a part of that third party group. I was working for a company called the Portal Group. And we managed all of Toyota's web portals, if you want to call them that.
Okay.
So Toyota.com, Lexus.com, Scion.com, and all of the properties that tie into those domains, we managed the services that ran those websites.
Okay.
So not all of that was in Amazon. Some of it was still hosted internally.
Mm.
But a pretty good portion of that was running in Amazon. And basically, it's kind of like I described. The business would say, hey, we have this, this need to have this type of site up and running. Where's the best place to put it?
Right.
Do we develop it and host it internally? Do we develop it and run it on the cloud? If we do run it on the cloud, you know, what's that architecture going to look like? And that's where we kind of would step in and say, well, you know, if it's this type of site, say it's just a, you know, static, simple site that we can just throw in an S3 bucket and, you know, we don't even worry about it. S3 being simple storage service. On Amazon, then, we just put it there and just kind of take care of itself. If it's a WordPress site, then, you know, yeah, we'll spin up the databases that support the virtual machines and the WordPress software that's running there, make sure it's load balanced and, you know, can handle the traffic that we would be anticipating. So we would, you know, really get down to the architectural part of it, whereas the business says, hey, this is, you know, the site, this is our vision for this, and, help us make it work.
What's the difference between the simple storage solution and a database solution? Because I think Rackspace was talking about that they're very, you know, database oriented, and I'm not quite sure I understand the details there.
And they were talking about some different, what was the new database?
MongoDB.
Yes.
And Hadoop and stuff like that.
Yeah. So, on the simple storage side, it's what I would call a key value store. So, I mean, the key could be as simple as a URL, just a web link, and it has, you know, one defined endpoint on the other side. So whenever you go to that URL, you're going to, you know, you're going to get that data served to you. Whereas, you know, from the database perspective, that's when you get into tables of data, with, you know, they may have key, if you're talking about the, you know, MySQL type database, or then you could have a NoSQL database like MongoDB. So with Amazon's RDS, you can define the backend, that you want. It could be MySQL. It could be NoSQL. They also have Oracle databases as well. So there's a lot of options there. It really kind of depends on the need of the application.
In terms of the end use, right? Like, okay, like I've seen S3, people store ebooks on there and, you know, content like that.
Sure.
So paint a picture for me of the end use of a database versus the storage use, if that makes sense.
Sure. So for the database, I would say variable content.
Okay.
That you need to access. I don't want to say in different ways because your MySQL front end is going to stay the same. But let's do so like the WordPress application, for example. It's going to have a database that it uses to store all of its configuration. It stores user data. You're going to be storing your blog posts in there, all the references to your images that are on the file system, that type of thing. Whereas S3 or just, you know, kind of this simple storage, it's almost like a file system on your computer.
Sort of like a more advanced Dropbox?
Yeah, kind of like that. It's like you know where the file is, and when you want it, you just go and get it. You don't have to develop any sort of query to pull that data from somewhere.
You don't have to sort through 10,000 names to find the one you're looking for, or 10,000 pictures to find the one you're looking for here.
Exactly. Could be the case that... say, for instance, you do have a WordPress database or a WordPress application that uses a database referencing an image, and that image could be in simple storage. So the simple storage is just kind of like a file system.
That's easy to access and navigate, whereas the database is going to have all this gobbledygook stuff that probably a non-technical person wouldn't understand, right? If they looked at in the database, it's like, what is this? But with the file server, you know what you're like, oh, okay, there's my ebook, there's my Word doc, there's my blog
and
post.
And it seems like a database is then it's what you can do with the data. You can manipulate it, you can use it, you can search it, you can compile it, you can arrange it, you can put it into, you know, whatever, lists and things.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. The database, Aaron said gobbledygook. I was going to say it's a little bit smarter.
This is from a non-technical perspective. Of course, it's like a language you don't understand, but you clearly understand the language because you're from the cloud society.
Yeah, right, you speak the secret cloudies.
I'll show you guys the handshake the next time.
Okay, good. Oh, I'd love to know it. So, all right, so we've got different kinds of ways to move this stuff off-site here. What's next? Have we just got it for the next 50 years? Or, I mean, they're talking about, I don't know, crazy things, quantum computing, virtual reality.
Internet of Things.
I mean, all this stuff, is that just, it's just built upon the same idea of a server sitting somewhere else and somebody else managing it for you? Or is this going to change the way we store and serve information to the world here?
I really do think it is. I think that what's going to happen is it's just going to be easier for people to access the compute capabilities that they need. I mean, new businesses starting up today, I would imagine that they wouldn't even want to purchase a data center or, you know, the infrastructure to have a data center.
Right.
They could just have it in the cloud, you know, for maybe just as much or maybe cheaper. So when you have that kind of capability, that's going to enable people to do more with less. So, you're definitely going to see more innovation from that. When you talk about, like, quantum computing and virtual reality, and we're getting faster hardware, smaller hardware. I mean, just look at the Apple Watch or Android Wear or devices like that. You get down to that scale and you have the network infrastructure that allows those devices to connect to compute resources that could be anywhere in the world. I think that just opens up so much opportunity for creativity and development.
And I'll tell you the two areas that I've seen that I don't think we've really explored enough, maybe we will in future episodes of the cloud, is one is third world. I want to open a business in Abu Dhabi or in, the Congo, and they don't have... very good electrical systems and other sorts of things. So I now get some sort of, I guess, what, satellite internet or something here. And I can open a really sophisticated business because I don't have to go buy. I can't buy the computers and ship them to the Congo. I can't run them in the humidity. I don't have the electrical consistency. The electricity goes down and stuff here. But if all that stuff is offside, yeah. I can create a business in places that were unimaginable before.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. I would say the next thing of that is information, you know, sharing information. So, yeah, if you have a device and you need to get that information, you know, anywhere, then, yeah, you're definitely going to be able to get it to people who might not have had that compute capability before.
You can build businesses in a third world environment, just as people. I marvel when I see pictures of Africa, and they show very backward by our standards, by Western standards, and very what we think poor and impoverished things. Nor running around with a cell phone. I mean, cell phones have been adopted even in the remotest parts of the world and are pretty common now. It's not uncommon to see a cell phone in a village in Africa or in India or something.
They leapfrogged the desktop era, and one other area I'm very excited about in cryptocurrency is that for them, they're already using that as a day-to-day sort of function, right? Through their phones, as you mentioned. So they actually, in a way, are a little more nimble with their, because they just skip desktops altogether because of economic reasons and
infrastructure reasons.
But like to your point, they're thriving with that. So what's that gonna, you know, like mobile is kind of becoming this like sleeping giant that is just blowing up, you know?
Right. And then the next thing I think, which everybody talks about, is this thing that scares everybody, just like we used to be scared of Big Brother after George Orwell wrote about it in 1984. Forever, that's burned into our brain. Big Brother is out there. Well, now Big Brother's got a companion. It's called Big Data. And this big data that exists, this big data seems to be the next level that we've got to conquer. We're still going to store it somewhere else. We've adopted that model, and we're going to have people like you guys out setting it up for us and managing it and protecting it and checking balancing the load of the internet traffic and all these sophisticated things. But we still haven't figured out what to do with the data. When everything is transmitting data, what are we going to do with that overloaded data?
Yeah, I agree with you there that I think big data is definitely kind of one of those things that I can't even say it's developing because it's already here.
Right.
People are taking advantage of it. Storage will be easy because, you know, we have these data centers. They're all over the world. And the storage is backed up and it's resilient. So, you know, the data is going to be there. I think really what it's going to come down to are the applications that can access the data and make sense of it. And that's where systems like Hadoop, you know, and MapReduce and those type of, you know, technologies.
Well, look at some of the topics we've had on the show. We had the chief data officer for the city of Los Angeles. They never had a chief data officer before. And his job is to envision ways as we collect massive amounts of data, as the parking meters talk to us. What do we do with that data? Maybe we turn it into an app that people can use to find out an open parking meter.
Sure. Yeah.
What excites you about the direction of technology? You know, I think we've started to touch on that, but I'm curious just from your experience, you know, you're in the trenches or the cloud, whatever.
You're floating up in the cloud there, looking down on all of us, this godlike figure floating up in the cloud here. And you look ahead and you say, now humans are ready for this.
Exactly.
Sure. Well, I can tell you for sure, one thing that excites me today is content delivery network. I was at Toyota, we use Akamai, and presently I'm working on a project to use Cloudflare, which are two content delivery or CDN providers. And basically what that does is it allows you to deliver content to clients or to people requesting your content faster, because what these providers do is they store a little bit of the data that's requested in their, what they call, edge data centers. So let's say, for instance, I have a website running here in Los Angeles.
Right.
And I have somebody that's trying to get to my website in New York. Well, Akamai and Cloudflare, they're going to have a data center in New York that has a little piece of my website. So when somebody requests it, they're going to get that information faster. They're not going to have to wait for those bits to transfer all the way from LA to New York.
Go through all the switching centers or whatever they call them here, where it goes yeah. to two or three points. Now, I always thought of content delivery networks as like, for example, we use a content delivery network to stream today's show. So we stream it to them, and they restream it at multiple bit rates on different platforms. So somebody on Android or Apple or whatever can hear this just as well. They do it at different speeds to accommodate different machines. They do all the, and they have a bigger, fatter pipeline than I do out of my studio here.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, this makes their experience that much richer on the receiving.
Right, and then people are talking about using CDNs for video transmission, for audio transmission, you're saying other things. Yeah, actually, I never thought of using a CDN to make your website move faster here and other bits of information.
Yeah, so yeah, that's what I'm excited about today. And as far as the future, like I said before, is just miniaturization, having more compute capability in smaller devices like cell phones, tablets, smartwatches, that type of thing. I think that's really going to get kind of crazy here in the next few years.
I agree.
If you could wave a magic wand, what would you change about the industry, how things work? I'll kind of give you some free rein there of what you would shift and what you've seen.
Instead of a magic wand, you're going to give you a way back machine. You're going to go way back and you're going to say, you know, I wish they had done this differently.
Sure. I wish that we had gone to cloud sooner.
Mm.
Or just the concept of cloud, because I think the concept of a centralized compute facility has always been there. Like, say, for instance, when I was in school, we used a VAC system, which is like this big honking computer in a basement somewhere.
Did it actually honk? You said a big honking. Did it make a honking sound? No,
I think it just kind of buzzed and whirred a little bit.
Right.
But, I mean, we didn't care where this computer was. We just connected to it. But the people who provided that service, they still hosted it in-house, as opposed to saying, hey, we can have this computer, have somebody else take care of the actual compute system somewhere else. We don't care, just as long as we can connect to it. I think if we had embraced that mentality early 90s, that type of thing, then I think where we would be today would be so much further than where we are.
But I'm going to give you, Aaron's going to have to go look this term up. Maybe you will too. I'm going to be a Luddite.
I know the Luddites.
Who fought technology.
They broke the machines, right?
Yeah.
From the Industrial Revolution, they didn't want this next wave of industry, so they broke all the machines
with
their hammers.
That's exactly right. There you go.
I didn't know you were a Luddite.
I'm a Luddite. So when the whole idea of taking all of this away from me and giving it to somebody else that I can't see or touch or call, but they're out there, I trust they're out there, they're saving it, they're storing it, they're protecting it, it seems like it opens up this reliance that should some disaster that nobody's figured out here, a 9/11 kind of thing that nobody figured out, an electromagnetic pulse that surrounds the Earth here from an atomic blast or some other crazy thing, it suddenly knocks me out of connection with all those things and therefore knocks me off the grid and shuts me down because I no longer, it's all interconnected. That seems to be the overall danger that everybody just minimizes and says, it'll never happen, like the giant electrical system we've created here. Yeah, I was here a couple of months ago, and something in Arizona blew up, and all of a sudden the power went off in Southern California for a day. You know, and they say, that'll never happen. It just seems like we open ourselves up as it becomes one massive grid stored and protected by somebody else. We average people are incapable then. If that fails, we have no option.
Yeah, on the infrastructure side, I mean, I know they do what they can to create resilience in the system by replicating data.
Right. It switches from one data center to another. This one has an earthquake, so we go to this data center, and it's got a backup of everything there.
Exactly.
And you're saying that that's a very well-oiled machine at this point and is continuing to become more refined over time?
Oh, indeed. Indeed. And I mean, there's data. I don't have it in front of me at the moment, but I mean, data to show that, the reliability of, say, S3 storage from Amazon has, you know, this percentage of availability. And you can find that type of information. But I would say if we have that electromagnetic pulse, or we have that, global type of event that really affects our ability to use our technical and technology infrastructure, I think we're going to have a bigger problem. You know, we're going to need to figure out how to have clean water. Where are we going to get our food from now?
Yeah, I know. This is what scares me. I sound like a Luddite and go break all the machines here. But but we're becoming so reliant on this network to do everything, and there's nothing that we can do ourselves. We can't do without it. And anything you can't do without, banks that are too big to fail, scare me when they do fail.
Yeah, indeed.
I'm surprised there hasn't been a Doomsday Preppers episode where they use that as one of the... Because the Doomsday Prepper people always have some fear of what would happen.
Right.
I wonder if anyone's like had that as their premise.
Well, science fiction always talks about the electromagnetic pulse, that apparently atomic bombs give off or other sorts of things that you could... You wouldn't do it to blow things up. You'd do it to disrupt the internet and everything that's connected to it. You would bring the electrical grid down and everything attached to it, the internet, and as you said, the water supply and the jails and everything. It's all connected to some grid here.
So we need an IT Doomsday Prepper for a future episode. that would be really funny. He's like, I'm a Linux engineer by day and I build a bunker by night.
That's right.
Michael, how do you keep up with the pace? And we're getting kind of close here.
Yeah, we've got like a minute.
Ask you, how do we keep up with the pace and then tell us how to get in touch with you? But start with, how you keep up with this fast-moving industry?
Yeah, sure. So the thing I like to do besides, reading blogs and just kind of following, trades online, that type of thing, are go to meetup. And actually, a meetup is where I met Aaron. I just like to talk to people. To
True.
Say, hey, what are your concerns, or what are you working on right now? And you just kind of bounce off, bounce ideas off of people to see, okay, is there something else that I don't know? And then I'll go and kind of find a book or a web page or take an online class or something to learn it. Or if there's something that I can, share with somebody else, then I'm always happy to, share that as well. But yeah, I just like to talk to people mostly, along with watching classes online, either through a service like Udemy or IT University, or, just
Khan Academy, like we talked about in one episode.
Yeah. All right, so if people want to talk to you, how do they reach you?
Well, my website is managedchaos.com.
Managed chaos. Okay. You just told me that I shouldn't worry. Now you tell me it's just managed chaos. Thanks.
Well, my tagline is everything's under control.
Okay. Well, that's what I want to hear. All right.
Yeah, because, the thing is, it's like there is some chaos when it comes to, architecting a service, particularly when it comes to computers, but yeah, everything's under control, but we can definitely take care of it.
All right, no worries here. All right,
and that's Michael Jenkins from managedchaos.com, Linux engineer. You can look him up. And don't forget, South Bay Foodies, that's his podcast. I got to plug you there, buddy.
Yeah, indeed. SouthBayFoodies.com, that's my personal blog where I cover food news and do restaurant reviews around the South Bay area of Los Angeles.
There you go. And how do we reach you, Aaron, and Network Remedy if they want to?
You can look me up on LinkedIn, Aaron Mungal, AaronManGal. And the show is sponsored by Network Remedy. We're really excited to talk to people about IT and helping to educate the public. And thank you all for listening. This has been wonderful.
Thanks.
And Michael, thank you so much. This has been actually one of the more understanding. we've kept the discussion pretty macro. This has been great. We got in the weeds a little bit, but I didn't feel it over my head. So
yeah,
I appreciate that.
I didn't lose you too often there. All right. Thanks guys so much. And we appreciate
it. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Well, this has been another episode of The Cloud, the only show that helps to try and clear up the confusion, the chaos, and demonstrate the potential, the possibilities, and yes, the problems of moving everything that you can think of to the cloud. Brought to you by Network Remedy and Orange County's only community radio station, octalkradio.net.
Thanks for listening to another episode of The Cloud. We hope you learned something valuable. To view our detailed show notes and links for further reading, please visit networkremedy.com/blog. Have you heard of the term shadow IT? It's a bit troubling, let me tell you. In a nutshell, shadow IT is when things out of your control and sometimes even knowledge happen. This is why many corporations are not big fans of solutions like Dropbox when it comes to internal data management. Now don't get me wrong, Dropbox is a very useful. In fact, we use it for the show. However, when it comes to your organization's precious data, there should be more robust solutions in place to ensure you have maximum protection and control. Meet Network Remedy's Cloud Sync, an enterprise-level file storage solution with military-grade security. We are offering any organization a free 30-day trial of Cloud Sync for unlimited users. Whether you have 10 users or several hundred users, this is the offer for you. And just for giving Cloud Sync a try, we will give you 5 user accounts free, 10 gigabytes each, indefinitely, just for giving us a chance. You truly have nothing to lose and much to gain. To start your free trial right away, please call 855-REMEDY-5 or visit online at networkremedy.com/contact. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.